Part 2 of Chapter 9 of John Brown by W. E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. From St. Catharines, John Brown went to Ingersoll, Hamilton, and Chatham. He also visited Toronto, holding meetings with Negroes in Temperance Hall and at the house of the late Mr. Holland, a colored man, on Queen Street West. On one occasion, Captain Brown remained as a guest with his friend, Dr. A.M. Ross, who is distinguished as a naturalist, as well as an intrepid abolitionist who risked his life on several occasions in excursions into the South to enable slaves to flee to Canada. Having finally perfected plans for a convention, Brown hurried back to Iowa for his men. During his 3 months' absence, they had been working and drilling in the Quaker settlement of Springdale, Iowa, as most persons supposed, for future troubles in Bleeding Kansas. On John Brown's arrival, they all hurriedly packed up. Owen Brown, Ralph, Kagi, Cook, Stevens, Tidd, Lehman, Moffat, Parsons, and the colored man Richardson, together with their recruits, Gill and Taylor. The Coppocks were to come later. The leave-taking between them and the people of Springdale was one of tears. Ties which had been knitting through many weeks were sundered, and not only so, but the natural sorrow at parting was intensified by the consciousness of all that the future was full of hazard for Brown and his followers. Before quitting the house and home of Mr. Maxon, where they had spent so long a time, each of Brown's band wrote his name in pencil on the wall of the parlor, where the writing still can be seen by the interested traveler. They all immediately started for Canada by way of Chicago and Detroit. At Chicago, they had to wait 12 hours, and the first hotel refused to accommodate Richardson at the breakfast table. John Brown immediately sought another place. The company arrived shortly in Chatham, and stopped at a hotel kept by Mr. Barber, a colored man. While at Chatham, John Brown, as Anderson relates, made a profound impression upon those who saw or became acquainted with him. Some supposed him to be a staid but modernized Quaker, others a solid businessman from somewhere, and without question a philanthropist. His long white beard, thoughtful and reverent brow and physiognomy, his sturdy, measured tread as he circulated about, with hands portrayed in the best lithograph under the pendant coat skirt of plain brown tweed, with other garments to match, revived to those honored with his acquaintance and knowing his history the memory of a Puritan of the most exalted type. John Brown's choice of Canada as a center of Negro culture was wise. There were nearly 50,000 Negroes there, and the number included many energetic, intelligent, and brave men, with some wealth. Settlements had grown up, farms had been bought, schools established, and an intricate social organization begun. Negroes like Henson had been loyally assisted by white men like King, and fugitives were welcomed and succored. Near Buxton, where King and the Elgin Association were working, was Chatham, the chief town of the county of Kent, with a large Negro population of farmers, merchants, and mechanics. They had a graded school, Wilberforce Institute, several churches, a newspaper, a fire engine company, and several organizations for social intercourse and uplift. One of the inhabitants said, "Mr. Brown did not overestimate the state of education of the colored people. He knew that they would need leaders and require training. His great hope was that the struggle would be supported by volunteers from Canada, educated and accustomed to self-government. He looked on our fugitives as picked men of sufficient intelligence, which, combined with a hatred for the South, would make them willing abettors of any enterprise destined to free their race." There were many white abolitionists nearby, but they distrusted Brown, and in this way he gained less influence among the Negroes than he otherwise might have had. Martin R. Delaney, who was a fervid African emigrationist, was just about to start to Africa, bearing the mandate of the last Negro convention, when John Brown appeared. On returning home from a professional visit in the country, Mrs. Delaney informed him that an old gentleman had called to see him during his absence. She described him as having a long, white beard, very gray hair, a sad but placid countenance. In speech, he was peculiarly solemn. She added, "He looked like one of the old prophets. He would neither come in nor leave his name, but promised to be back in 2 weeks' time." Finally, Delaney met John Brown, who said, "I come to Chatham expressly to see you, this being my third visit on the errand. I must see you at once, sir," he continued, with emphasis, "and that too in private, as I have much to do and but little time before me. If I am to do nothing here, I want to know it at once." Delaney continues, "Going directly to the private parlor of a hotel nearby, he at once revealed to me that he desired to carry out a great project in his scheme of Kansas emigration, which, to be successful, must be aided and countenanced by the influence of a general convention or council. That he was unable to effect in the United States, but had been advised by distinguished friends of his and mine that, if he could but see me, his object could be attained at once." On my expressing astonishment at the conclusion to which my friends and himself had arrived, with a nervous impatience, he exclaimed, "Why should you be surprised? Sir, the people of the northern states are cowards. Slavery has made cowards of them all. The whites are afraid of each other, and the blacks are afraid of the whites. You can effect nothing among such people," he added, with decided emphasis. On assuring him, if a council was all that was desired, he could readily obtain it, he replied, "That is all, but that is a great deal to me. It is men I want, and not money. Money I can get plentiful enough, but no men. Money can come without being seen, but men are afraid of identification with me, though they favor my measures. They are cowards, sir, cowards," he reiterated. He then fully revealed his designs. "With these I found no fault, but fully favored, and aided in getting up the convention." Meantime, John Brown proceeded carefully to sound public opinion, got the views of others, and, while revealing few of his own plans, set about getting together a body who were willing to ratify his general aims. He consulted the leading Negroes in private, and called a series of small conferences to thresh out preliminary difficulties. In these meetings and in the personal visits, many points arose and were settled. A member of the convention says, "One evening, the question came up as to what flag should be used. Our English colored subjects, who had been naturalized, said they would never think of fighting under the hated stars and stripes. Too many of them thought they carried their emblem on their backs. But Brown said the old flag was good enough for him. Under it, freedom had been won from the tyrants of the old world for white men. Now he intended to make it do duty for the black men. He declared emphatically that he would not give up the stars and stripes." That settled the question. Someone proposed admitting women as members, but Brown strenuously opposed this, and warned the members not to intimate, even to their wives, what was done. "One day in my shop, I told him how utterly hopeless his plans would be if he persisted in making an attack with the few at his command, and that we could not afford to spare white men of his stamp, ready to sacrifice their lives for the salvation of black men. While I was speaking, Mr. Brown walked to and fro, with his hands behind his back, as was his custom when thinking on his favorite subject. He stopped suddenly, and bringing down his right hand with great force, exclaimed, Did not my master Jesus Christ come down from heaven and sacrifice himself upon the altar for the salvation of the race? And should I, a worm not worthy to crawl under his feet, refuse to sacrifice myself? With a look of determination, he resumed his walk. In all the conversations I had with him during his stay in Chatham of nearly a month, I never once saw a smile light upon his countenance. He seemed to be always in deep and earnest thought. The preliminary meeting was held in a frame cottage on Princess Street, south of King Street, then known as the King Street High School. Some meetings were also held in the First Baptist Church on King Street. In order to mislead the inquisitive, it was pretended that the persons assembling were organizing a Masonic lodge of colored people. The important proceedings took place in No. 3 Engine House, a wooden building near McGregor's Creek, erected by Mr. Holden and other colored men. The regular invitations were issued on the 5th. Chatham, Canada, May 5th, 1858. My dear friend, I have called a quiet convention in this place of true friends of freedom. Your attendance is earnestly requested. Your friend, John Brown. The convention was called together at 10 a.m., Saturday, May 8th, and opened without ceremony. There were present the following Negroes: William Charles Monroe, a Baptist clergyman, formerly president of the Emigration Convention and elected president of this assembly; Martin R. Delaney, afterward major in the United States Army in the Civil War; Alfred Whipper of Pennsylvania; William Lambert and I.D. Shad of Detroit, Michigan; James H. Harris of Cleveland, Ohio, after the war a representative in Congress for 2 terms from North Carolina; G.J. Reynolds, an active Underground Railroad leader of Sandusky City; J.C. Grant; A.J. Smith; James M. Jones, a gunsmith and engraver, graduate of Oberlin College, 1849; M.F. Bailey; S. Hunton; John J. Jackson; Jeremiah Anderson; James M. Bell; Alfred Ellisworth; James W. Purnell; George Aiken; Stephen Detton; Thomas Hickerson; John Cannell; Robinson Alexander; Thomas F. Carey; Thomas M. Kennard; Robert Van Vanken; Thomas Stringer; John A. Thomas, believed by some to be John Brown's earlier confidant and employee at Springfield, Massachusetts, afterward employed by Abraham Lincoln in his Illinois home and at the White House also; Robert Newman; Charles Smith; Simon Fislin; Isaac Holden, a merchant and surveyor and John Brown's host; James Smith; and Richard Richardson. Hinton says, "There is no evidence to show that Douglas, Logan, Garnet, Stephen Smith, Gloucester, Langston, or others of the prominent men of color in the States who knew John Brown were invited to the Chatham meeting. It is doubtful if their appearance would have been wise, as it would assuredly have been commented on and aroused suspicion." The white men present were John and Owen Brown, father and son; John Henry Kagi; Aaron Dwight Stevens, still known as Charles Whipple; John Edwin Cook; Richard Ralph; George R. Gill; Charles Plummer Tidd; William Henry Lehman; Charles W. Moffat; Luke F. Parsons, all of Kansas; and Stuart Taylor of Canada, 12 in all. It has been usually assumed that Jeremiah Anderson was white, but the evidence makes it possible that he was a mulatto. John J. Jackson called the meeting to order, and Monroe was chosen president. Delaney then asked for John Brown, and Brown spoke at length, followed by Delaney and others. The Constitution was brought forward, and after a solemn parole of honor, was read. It proved to be a frame of government based on the national constitution, but much simplified and adapted to a moving band of guerrillas. The first 45 articles were accepted without debate. The next article was, "The foregoing articles shall not be so as in any way to encourage the overthrow of any state government, or the general government of the United States, and look to no dissolution of the Union, but simply to amendment and repeal, and our flag shall be the same that our fathers fought for under the Revolution." To this, Reynolds, the coppersmith, one of the strongest men in the convention, objected. He felt no allegiance to the nation that had robbed and humiliated him. Brown, Delaney, Kagi, and others, however, earnestly advocated the article, and it passed. Saturday afternoon, the Constitution was finally adopted and signed. Brown induced James M. Jones, who had not attended all the sittings, to come to this one, as the Constitution must be signed, and he wished his name to be on the roll of honor. As the paper was presented for signature, Brown said, "Now, friend Jones, give us John Hancock, bold and strong." The account continues. During one of the sittings, Mr. Jones had the floor, and discussed the chances of the success or failure of the slaves rising to support the plan proposed. Mr. Brown's scheme was to fortify some place in the mountains and call the slaves to rally under his colors. Jones expressed fear that he would be disappointed because the slaves did not know enough to rally to his support. The American slaves, Jones argued, were different from those of the West Indian island of San Domingo, whose successful uprising is a matter of history, as they had there imbibed some of the impetuous character of their French masters, and were not so overawed by white men. "Mr. Brown no doubt thought," says Mr. Jones, "that I was making an impression on some of the members, if not on him, for he arose suddenly and remarked, 'Friend Jones, you will please say no more on that side. There will be a plenty to defend that side of the question.'" A general laugh took place. A question as to the time for making the attack came up in the convention. Some advocated that we should wait until the United States became involved in war with some first-class power, that it would be next to madness to plunge into a strife for the abolition of slavery while the government was at peace with other nations. Mr. Brown listened to the argument for some time, then slowly arose to his full height and said, "I would be the last one to take the advantage of my country in the face of a foreign foe." He seemed to regard it as a great insult. That settled the matter, in my mind, that John Brown was not insane. At 6 p.m., the election of officers under the Constitution took place, and was finished Monday, the 10th. John Brown was elected Commander-in-Chief, Kagi, Secretary of War, Ralph, Secretary of State, Owen Brown, Treasurer, and George B. Gill, Secretary of the Treasury. Members of Congress chosen were Alfred Ellsworth and Osborne P. Anderson, colored. After appointing a committee to fill other offices, the convention adjourned. Another and a larger body was also organized. As Delaney says, "This organization was an extensive body, holding the same relation to his movements as a state or national executive committee holds to its party principles, directing their adherence to fundamental principles." This committee still existed at the time of the Harper's Ferry raid. With characteristic reticence, Brown revealed his whole plan to no one, and many of those close to him received quite different impressions, or rather read their own ideas, into Brown's careful speech. One of his Kansas band says, "I am sure that Brown did not communicate the details of his plans to the members of the convention more than in a very general way. Indeed, I do not now remember that he gave them any more than the impressions which they could gather from the methods of organization. From those who were directly connected with his movements, he solicited plans and methods, including localities, of operations in writing. Of course, we had almost precise knowledge of his methods, but all of us, perhaps, did not know just the locality selected by him, or, if knowing, did not comprehend the resources and surroundings." "John Brown never, I think," said Mr. Jones, "communicated his whole plan, even to his immediate followers. In his conversations with me, he led me to think that he intended to sacrifice himself and a few of his followers for the purpose of arousing the people of the North from the stupor they were in on this subject. He seemed to think such sacrifice necessary to awaken the people from the deep sleep that had settled upon the minds of the whites of the North. He well knew that the sacrifice of any number of Negroes would have no effect. What he intended to do, so far as I could gather from his conversation from time to time, was to emulate Arnold Winkelried, the Swiss chieftain, when he threw himself upon the Austrian spearmen, crying, 'Make way for liberty.'" Delaney, in his own bold, original way, assumed that Brown intended another Underground Railroad terminating in Kansas. Delaney himself was on his way to Africa and could take no active part in the movement. The Constitution adopted by the Convention was an instrument designed for the government of a band of isolated people fighting for liberty. The preamble said, "Whereas slavery, throughout its entire existence in the United States, is none other than a most barbarous, unprovoked, and unjustifiable war of one portion of its citizens upon another portion, the only conditions of which are perpetual imprisonment and hopeless servitude or absolute extermination, in utter disregard and violation of those eternal and self-evident truths set forth in our Declaration of Independence. Therefore, we, citizens of the United States, and the oppressed people, who, by a recent decision of the Supreme Court, are declared to have no rights which the white man is bound to respect, together with all other people degraded by the laws thereof, do, for the time being, ordain and establish ourselves the following provisional constitution and ordinances, the better to protect our persons, property, lives, and liberties, and to govern our actions." The Declaration of Independence referred to was probably designed to be adopted July 4, 1858, when, as originally planned, the blow was to be actually struck. It was a paraphrase of the original declaration, and ended by saying, "Declaring that we will serve them no longer as slaves, knowing that the laborer is worthy of his hire, we therefore, the representatives of the circumscribed citizens of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the oppressed citizens of the slave states solemnly publish and declare that the slaves are and of right ought to be as free and as independent as the unchangeable law of God requires that all men shall be, that they are absolved from all allegiance to those tyrants who still persist in forcibly subjecting them to perpetual bondage, and that all friendly connection between them and such tyrants is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent citizens of these states, they have a perfect right, a sufficient and just cause, to defend themselves against the tyranny of their oppressors. To solicit aid from and ask the protection of all true friends of humanity and reform, of whatever nation and wherever found, a right to contract all alliances and to do all other acts and things which free independent citizens may of right do, and for the support of the Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives and our sacred honor. The Constitution consisted of 48 articles. All persons of mature age were admitted to membership, and there was established a Congress with one house of 5 to 10 members, a president and vice president, and a court of 5 members, each one of whom held circuit courts. All these officials were to unite in selecting a commander-in-chief, treasurer, secretaries, and other officials. All property was to be in common, and no salaries were to be paid. All persons were to labor. All indecent behavior was forbidden. The marriage relation shall be at all times respected, and families kept together, as far as possible, and broken families encouraged to reunite, and intelligence offices established for that purpose. Schools and churches established as soon as may be for the purpose of religious and other instructions, and the first day of the week regarded as a day of rest, and appropriated to moral and religious instruction and improvement, relief of the suffering, instruction of the young and ignorant, and the encouragement of personal cleanliness. Nor shall any person be required on that day to perform ordinary manual labor, unless in extremely urgent cases. All persons were to carry arms, but not concealed. There were special provisions for the capture of prisoners, and protection of their persons and property. John Brown was well pleased with his work, and wrote home, "Had a good abolition convention here, from different parts, on the 8th and 10th instante mense, constitution slightly amended and adopted, and society organized." Just now, as everything seemed well started, came disquieting news from the East. Forbes had been there since November, growing more and more poverty-stricken and angry, and his threats, hints, and visits were becoming frequent and annoying. He complained to Senator Wilson, to Charles Sumner, to Hale, Seward, and Horace Greeley, and to the Boston Coterie. He could not understand why these leaders of the movement against slavery, as he supposed, should leave the real power in the hands of John Brown, and neglect an experienced soldier like himself after raising false expectations. John Brown had dealt with Forbes gently but firmly, and had sought to conciliate him, but in vain. Brown was apparently determined to outwit him by haste. He had written his Massachusetts friends to join him at the Chatham Convention, but Sanborn and Howe had already received threatening letters from Forbes, which alarmed them. He evidently had careful information of Brown's movements, and was bent on making trouble. He probably was at this time in the confidence of McCune Smith, and the able Negro group of New York, who had developed a not unnatural distrust of whites, and a desire to foster race pride. Using information thus obtained, Forbes sought to put pressure on Republican leaders to organize more effective warfare on slavery, and to discredit John Brown. Sanborn wrote hastily, "It looks as if the project must, for the present, be deferred, for I find, by reading Forbes's epistles to the doctor, that he knows the details of the plan, and even knows, what very few do, that the doctor, Mr. Stearns, and myself, are informed of it. How he got this knowledge is a mystery. He demands that Hawkins, John Brown, be dismissed as agent, and himself or some other be put in his place, threatening otherwise to make the business public. Gerrit Smith concluded, Brown must go no further. But Higginson wisely demurred. I regard any postponement, he said, as simply abandoning the project, for if we give it up now, at the command or threat of HF, it will be the same next year. The only way is to circumvent the man somehow, if he cannot be restrained in his malice. When the thing is well started, who cares what he says? Further efforts were made to conciliate Forbes, but he wrote wildly, I have been grossly defrauded in the name of humanity and anti-slavery. I have for years labored in the anti-slavery cause without wanting or thinking of a recompense. Though I have made the least possible parade of my work, it has nevertheless not been entirely without fruit. Patience and mild measures having failed, I reluctantly have recourse to harshness. Let them not flatter themselves that I shall eventually become weary and drop the subject. It is as yet quite at its beginning. To go on in face of this is madness, wrote Sanborn, and John Brown was urged to come to New York to meet Stearns and Howe. Brown had already been delayed nearly a month at Chatham by this trouble, but he obeyed the summons. Sanborn says, when, about May 20th, Mr. Stearns met Brown in New York, it was arranged that hereafter the custody of the Kansas Rifles should be in Brown's hands as the agent not of this committee, but of Mr. Stearns alone. It so happened that Gerrit Smith, who seldom visited Boston, was coming there late in May. He arrived and took rooms at the Revere House, where on the 24th of May, 1858, the secret committee, organized in March and consisting of Smith, Parker, Howe, Higginson, Stearns, and Sanborn, held a meeting to consider the situation. It had already been decided to postpone the attack, and the arms had been placed under a temporary interdict, so that they could only be used, for the present, in Kansas. The questions remaining were whether Brown should be required to go to Kansas at once, and what amount of money should be raised for him in the future. Of the six members of the committee, only one, Higginson, was absent. It was unanimously resolved that Brown ought to go to Kansas at once. As soon as possible after this, on May 21st, Brown visited Boston, and, while there, held a conversation with Higginson, who made a record of it at the time. He states that Brown was full of regret at the decision of the Revere House Council to postpone the attack till the winter or spring of 1859, when the secret committee would raise for Brown $2,000 or $3,000. He, meantime, was to blind Forbes by going to Kansas, and to transfer the property so as to relieve the Kansas Committee of responsibility, they, in future, not to know his plans. On probing Brown, Higginson goes on, I found that he considered delay very discouraging to his 13 men and to those in Canada. Impossible to begin in autumn, and he would not lose a day, he finally said, if he had $300. It would not cost $25 apiece to get his men from Ohio, and that was all he needed. The knowledge that Forbes could give of his plan would be injurious, for he wished his opponents to underrate him. But still, the increased terror produced would perhaps counterbalance this, and it would not make much difference. If he had the means, he would not lose a day. He complained that some of his Eastern friends were not men of action, that they were intimidated by Wilson's letter, and magnified the obstacles. Still, it was essential that they should not think him reckless, he said, and as they held the purse, he was powerless without them, having spent nearly everything received this campaign, on account of delay, a month at Chatham. etc. There was nothing now for Brown but to conceal his arms, scatter his men, and hide a year in Kansas. It was a bitter necessity, and it undoubtedly helped ruin the success of the foray. The Negroes in Canada fell away from the plan when it did not materialize, and doubted Brown's determination and wisdom. His son hid the arms in northern Ohio, in a haymow. Meantime, a part of the company, Stevens, Cook, Tidd, Gill, Taylor, and Owen Brown, immediately after the adjournment of the convention, had gone to Cleveland, Ohio, and had found work in the surrounding country. Brown wrote from Canada at the time, "It seems that all but three have managed to stop their board bills, and I do hope the balance will follow the manlike and noble example of patience and perseverance set them by the others, instead of being either discouraged or out of humor. The weather is so wet here that no work can be obtained. I have only received $15 from the East, and such has been the effect of the course taken by F., Colonel Forbes, on our Eastern friends, that I have some fears that we shall be compelled to delay further action for the present. They, his Eastern friends, urge us to do so, promising us liberal assistance after a while. I am in hourly expectation of help sufficient to pay off our bills here, and to take us on to Cleveland to see and advise with you, which we shall do at once when we shall get the means. Suppose we do have to defer our direct efforts. Shall great and noble minds either indulge in useless complaint, or fold their arms in discouragement, or sit in idleness, when we may at least avoid losing ground? It is in times of difficulty that men show what they are. It is in such times that men mark themselves. Are our difficulties such as to make us give up one of the noblest enterprises in which men ever were engaged?" Two weeks later, the rest of the party, except Kagi, followed to Cleveland, John Brown going east to meet Stearns. Kagi, who was an expert printer, went to Hamilton, Canada, where he set up and printed the Constitution, arriving in Cleveland about the middle of June when John Brown returned from the east. Ralph says that Brown did not have much money, but sent him to New York and Washington to watch Forbes and possibly regain his confidence. Ralph, however, had become timid and lukewarm in the cause and sailed away to England. The rest of the men scattered. Owen Brown went to Akron, Ohio. Cook left Cleveland for the neighborhood of Harper's Ferry. Gill secured work in a Shaker settlement, probably Lebanon, Ohio, where Tidd was already employed. Stuart Taylor went to Illinois. Stevens awaited Brown at Cleveland, while Lehman got some work in Ashtabula County. John Brown left Boston on the 3rd of June, proceeding to the North Elba home for a short visit. Then he, Kagi, Stevens, Lehman, Gill, Parsons, Moffat, and Owen were gathered together, and the party went to Kansas, arriving late in June. Thus, suddenly, ended John Brown's attempt to organize the Black Phalanx. His intimate friends understood that the great plan was only postponed, but the postponement had, as Higginson predicted, a dampening effect, and Brown's chances of enlisting a large Canadian contingent were materially lessened. Nevertheless, seed had been sown, and there were millions of human beings to whom the last word of the Chatham Declaration of Independence was more than mere rhetoric. Nature is mourning for its murdered and afflicted children. Hung be the heavens in scarlet. End of chapter 9.